Green blessings.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Green blessings, everybody. Gee, there's usually a song. Are we going to get a song?
Hi.
I don't know.
Hi, Susan. Hello.
Hi, Justine. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Just fine.
Good.
Kind of
I'm
a
not
hot
sure
and muggy
song...
day here in the Catskills.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the song is, but I see that someone's here and has a question. Shall we jump right in?
I guess we might as well jump right in then.
Okay, very good. Hello there. Do you have a question for Susan?
I do indeed, and thank you for taking it. My name is Marie, and I had an abdominal ultrasound and learned that I have a 0.3 centimeter kidney stone in the lower pole in my right kidney, and there's some, I don't know, a little something in the left. So I have been researching some home remedies to alleviate that or to cure it or to cleanse it out. Do you have any suggestions?
Did you get the ultrasound because you're in pain?
Yeah. I was just in discomfort. I wasn't in pain. I'm in a little pain right now.
You're in a little bit of pain.
Yes.
Women have said to me that the pain of passing a kidney stone is far greater than the pain of giving birth.
Oh, I haven't reached that level yet. Thank God.
So it can be exceedingly painful to do this on your own. What did the doctor recommend?
Well, I'm waiting for her. I picked up the report, and I asked her assistant to give me a call to see what our next step would be.
Because what is being done most of the time these days is that they have a sonic wave,
mm-hmm.
that the sound wave that actually breaks up the kidney stone.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't surgery. It's this sonic wave. It's an outpatient procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stone can be passed. Let me tell you a rather scary and somewhat horrifying story. An excellent herbalist by the name of Michael Moore has many books to his credit. He has helped many, many, many people regain their health. Very well-respected herbalist and smart man. And he had some pain, and he said, well, I must be passing a kidney stone. And he started taking herbs to help him pass the kidney stone. Now, the problem that is inherent in home remedies for kidney stones is that the kidneys themselves are insensate. There are no nerves to the kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have kidney damage. You can even have your kidney die, and you wouldn't feel it. You start to feel a kidney stone when it passes out of the kidney and into the tube. And then the pressure of the stone in that tube starts to create pain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do not act quickly enough, that stone actually blocks the fluid from coming out of the kidney, and it backs up into the kidney, and the kidney does die.
Mm-hmm.
So he's using herbs. He's very knowledgeable. He's using herbs to help pass the kidney stones, and he wasn't aware that one of the stones did lodge in that tube. And by the time he stopped urinating completely and went to the hospital, he had 50% of one kidney left functioning.
Wow.
And they said to him, okay, you're an herbalist. Go home and make your other kidney work. Make this kidney that's functioning 50%. Make it work 100%. You can live with one kidney. But if you can't get it to work better, you're going to be dead within 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
He is dead.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
You there, Susan?
I'm right here.
Okay.
I am quelling the impulse left over from previous Tuesday to hang up after somebody says goodbye.
I'm so glad that you're not hanging up. Good, wonderful.
Right.
Thank you.
Last week, I actually had my finger on hang up twice, and the apprentice are going, don't. So they're helping me out.
So I have literally a mountain of questions here.
All right.
I mean, a mountain of them. So, shall we just dive in?
I guess so.
Okay.
All right.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for your wonderful radio show, website, and YouTube channel. Through childhood, I suffered from bronchitis. The symptoms went away after puberty, but for the past 10 years, I've been working as a music teacher, and I come in contact with a lot of sick children. So now I have a lot of sinus congestion. And for 5 years, I've been taking all kinds of antibiotics, but they haven't been working. And so I went for allergy screening, and it turns out I'm allergic to environmental allergens, which means basically everything. I've been taking allergy shots every 3 weeks. And this month, I took echinacea, and it worked. My symptoms stopped, and for the first time in my career, I'm ready to enjoy my summer vacation. I'm not sure if I can use it every day for the rest of my life or if there's any way to boost my immune system and avoid infection. By the way, I've been taking red clover infusion after reading your childbearing yearbook because I want to have a child as soon as I'm done with the allergy shot. I eat a lot of garlic, and I've been drinking kombucha. What are your thoughts on kombucha? I've been making my own green tea kombucha and drinking about a cup a day. What do you know about the secondary effects of allergy shot treatment? I can't find anything online about that. What daily herbal remedy would you recommend for someone like me who is allergic to environmental allergens? I'm not giving up on living at large because of the sniffles. I am also allergic to pets, but I do have a dog. Thank you.
Wow. Long question. I wish that this person was available for me to ask a few questions of. The first thing I would ask is who did the allergy testing? Because there are a variety of different ways that allergy testing can be done.
An ENT for an in-depth allergy screening.
So, ears, nose, and throat specialist. So it sounds like an MD did it. So generally what's done is a scratch test where different allergens are put on the skin and we see if the skin reacts to them. So, how can I typify this or explain this simply? Basically, when we have an allergic reaction to something, and I'm using this in the way that she's using it, which is really not the right way to use it at all. An allergy is a life-threatening response to a substance. And there, you can never get over an allergy. If you are allergic to bee stings, every bee sting you ever get could kill you. And you don't get over allergies. If you're allergic to peanuts, you don't get over your peanut allergy. What she is really talking about is sensitivities, or that she reacts to things. And you can change your sensitivities and you can change your reactions. Now let's start from the wise woman perspective. The wise woman perspective and immune system response to pollens, to dander, and to a variety of chemicals is a smart, reasonable, healthy response. Somebody came to the Wise Woman Center for Moon Lodge the other day and put a whole bunch of essential oil of citronella on themselves. I do not consider myself allergic in any way at all. But as soon as I walked outside from the house, because I was bringing out the yarrow spray, which is what we use as an insect repellent, I was hit as though somebody hit me on the head with a sledgehammer by this essential oil. And I walked up to the group. By the time I got up to where she was, I felt like I was going to pass out. The world was whirling around. I felt incredibly nauseated, and I asked her to please wash it off. I don't consider that a problem with me. I don't consider that my body doing something wrong. I consider that my health. I consider that my body doing something right. I consider that my body having a little temper tantrum and saying, I am not going to be okay if you let this vile poison be around me. So she seems to have gone to someone in the scientific tradition who agrees with her that having a reaction to chemicals is somehow not something that should be going on, and that she wants me to tell her how to basically silence her body, choke her body off, and make sure that her body doesn't keep her safe and healthy.
Well, I'm not reading that at all here, so I'm not sure what's going on for you. She says she's a teacher. She comes in contact with a lot of sick children, and that's making her sick.
Children don't give you allergies. That's why I said, wow, at the end of it, because, hey, the bronchitis, the sick children, this is pretty clear, and we can definitely do something. But then she goes and she starts talking about, I have all these allergies, and I'm, you know, taking these allergy shots. And that's where I'm picking this up, is that this is something different from the bronchitis. She said it was upper respiratory. It's sinus. So this sounds to me like two separate and different things.
Okay, well, there's a huge stack of questions here, so if you don't want to answer this question, then maybe you should just say that. There were three parts to the question. The first was, what do you think about kombucha? I'm drinking a cup a day. Is that safe?
I have no objection to anyone drinking vinegar. That's what kombucha is. It is basically vinegar, and there's nothing wrong with it. Do I think that kombucha itself has any health-giving property? No, I don't. But I don't have any objection to it. She's making her own kombucha. Somebody could object because we have had a couple of people who are immune-compromised die from drinking kombucha that was made at home because various molds and other things can get into it at home. And people with suppressed immune systems or who are taking any kind of drug that suppresses the immune system sometimes have the ability to get very sick from a contaminated kombucha. And then the second question was?
What do you know about the secondary effects of allergy shot treatment? I've looked online and there's nothing alarming about it.
I guess it depends on what kind of shots she's getting. Generally, what I know about it is that when people are getting allergy shots, they're getting dilute amounts of the things that they are allergic to. As a matter of fact, this is one of the places where modern medicine becomes almost homeopathic. And that is, of course, what a homeopath would do, or even an herbalist. I remember I was giving a class once, and it was at a horticultural conference, and I asked people to name the plants that they had the hardest time with, and of course they named a whole bunch of weeds. And I had a big blackboard, and I wrote the name of all these weeds in the blackboard. And I said, okay, let's erase any plants on the blackboard that are useless. And several people said, ragweed is useless, and it gives people allergic reactions. And as though they had planned it, and they hadn't because they didn't know each other, on the right side of the room a woman stood up, on the left side of the room a man stood up, and in unison they said, tincture the ragweed in flour and take it in. You won't have any pollen allergies, especially not to ragweed pollen. So the very first plant that the people wanted to erase from the board turned out to be one of the best remedies for people who were having allergic or sensitive reactions to the pollen from that plant. So far as I know, that's what she's being given shots of, the actual things that she has tested sensitive to. And she could, if she'd rather not have the shots, do that herself by knowing what those things are and making a tincture of them and taking it in tiny amounts, or taking those things already prepared by homeopaths.
Okay,
and then there was a third question.
what daily herbal remedy would you recommend for someone who is sensitive to environmental allergens, particularly pollen and pet allergy?
Right. Nettle, of course, is well known as being a plant that can help people overcome sensitivities to pollen, animal dander, and a variety of other things. I like for the students that I'm working with who are dealing with environmental sensitivities, I like them to keep with them a tin of slippery elm balls, because often if you are in the throes of a reaction, the slippery elm can stop that reaction. Osha, Ligusticum porteri, Osha root tincture, is also a tremendous ally for helping to open the breathing. And I have used it to help avert serious consequences when people have been stung by a bee or eaten peanuts when they were truly allergic. And we were in places where there was no ambulance available, and those people could have died. And in one case, the one woman was actually already turning blue. Her skin was blue and her lips were blue. And the OSHA tincture was able to repink her and move her through that event so that she did not have any repercussions from eating something that she is deathly allergic to. So I wouldn't use slippery elm on a daily basis. I wouldn't use OSHA on a daily basis. I wouldn't even use nettle on a daily basis. I believe she said she's using red clover infusion, and that's wonderful. And I think that 2 or 3 quarts of red clover infusion a week is plenty. And so the days when she's not drinking red clover, she could certainly drink nettle infusion, and that would give her an infusion to drink every single day. And that's the kind of daily thing that I would do. If she's getting good results with echinacea, certainly that is something that she can continue to use. But many people have told me that when they got good results with echinacea and then started using it on a daily basis, that it then didn't work well for them. And there are certainly several mechanisms by which we could see that that could be possible. There was, however, a study just done in Switzerland, and they had people take a small amount of echinacea tincture on a daily basis throughout a cold and flu season, and they did in fact find that those people had fewer colds and less flu.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm not sure. Is there, do we have somebody on the line who'd like to ask Susan a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Go right ahead.
Is this me? Am I online?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
That's right.
Sorry. Hi, Susan. Nice to meet you. Very excited to be here. I'm a 47-year-old, and in March I was diagnosed quite by surprise with uterine cancer. I had my surgery in April, and I was lucky in many ways because it was found at an early stage, but it has some element of grade 3 cells, which means they tend to be a little more aggressive. And I'm also in surgical menopause. So you know how they say it's good, you know, stress can make your hot flashes worse. Well, it's kind of hard. I'm, you know, managing my mental state is a big enough thing on my own. But my the focus of my question, it's really about how to manage hot flashes and the temperature instability that I'm experiencing a lot of, which is cutting into my sleep and, you know, right now the biggest quality of life reducer, while keeping things safe to not as herbally. I want to find herbs that won't be stimulating any remaining cancer cells that could be in me to grow. I'm going to try to eat a really low carb, high fat diet for a while, try and kind of go ketogenically, meaning, you know, try to make an environment that won't be hospitable to cancer cells. But I need some kind of, I'm going to try acupuncture, but there's all kinds of herbs I can take, but if I spend any time online, I find that a lot of them are phytoestrogens, which can be protective or could be hazardous. And it's really hard to navigate how to make a choice for an herb to take know that I'm.
Okay, so let me establish this for you. Every seed and every root contains phytoestrogens. Every seed and every root. So if you're going to avoid phytoestrogens, you cannot eat any grain of any kind. You cannot eat any beans, and you cannot eat any nuts. You cannot eat sesame seeds or flax seeds or poppy seeds. You cannot eat any fruit in which you eat the seeds, like kiwi, blueberry, raspberry, nor can you eat any roots of any kind. Now, this doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, and I understand that not all phytoestrogen isn't necessarily a dirty word at all. It actually sounds like it's been a harmful.
As a matter of fact, avoiding herbs that are phytoestrogenic is completely beside the point, so long as you're eating foods that are phytoestrogenic.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Well, I'm just starting to try to figure out which. It seems like some are phytoestrogenic in a bad way, and some are phytoestrogenic. You know, some act on the receptors that make a cancer cells possibly grow, and others seem to inhibit tumor growth, like specifically, like soy.
I know it's,
soy seems to
is,
really
it's confusing, isn't it? And that's because estrogen receptor sites are generalists. And let me tell you why they're generalists. First of all, women make 30 different kinds of estrogen. And so estrogen receptor sites right away have to be generalists because we're making 30 different varieties. Estrone, estrace, estradiol, those are just three of them. Secondly, there are literally tens of thousands of plants that contain phytoestrogens.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to make use of these, the estrogen receptor site needs to be a generalist. Now, where it gets kind of cranky is that there are also tens of thousands of chemicals that act like estrogens that are in our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So to make this a little simpler for you, let me tell you that scientists divide all of these thousands and thousands of estrogens into two classes, short-path estrogens and long-path estrogens.
Path or path?
P-A-T-H, path, like a way. I took the path out to the barn.
Okay.
Short-path or long-path. And what this refers to is how long or short it takes for that estrogen to be metabolized. So the body protects itself against cancer by metabolizing the short-path estrogens very quickly and getting them to the cells. And they block the growth of cancer. Tamoxifen is a short-path estrogen.
Uh-huh.
Long-path estrogens can feed cancer. And
okay.
It takes them a longer time to get to the cells. So the ideal is to have many more short-path estrogens in the body than long-path estrogens, and in that way, we protect ourselves against cancer. So eating more phytoestrogenic plants protects against the chemical estrogens in the environment.
So the plants tend to be short-path while the chemical estrogens tend to be long path.
Excellent. That's exactly right.
Oh, I didn't mean to butt in.
You didn't butt in at all. No, that's perfect. That's excellent. That's just what I want you to understand. Now, there's a couple of herbs or plants that seem to kind of be on the fence or maybe even cross the border over into long path. The first of those is soy. And I always recommend that anyone who's dancing with cancer avoid soy except for miso.
That's all I'm taking. Well, is tamari, what about tamari?
Tamari is fine, so long as it's actual tamari.
Yeah,
and not soy sauce. Yeah, the real thing,
no,
exactly. Man. Wonderful. Wonderful. Those are both proven anti-cancer foods.
That's good. I've heard they're good for the bones also.
Yeah. Good for what?
Bones.
I'm sorry, they're good for what?
Bone preservation.
They're not good for the bones. No, they're not good for your bones. No, nourishing herbal infusions are good for your bones. I would also, just for the listener's sake, like to tell them that your ovaries, you allowed your ovaries to be removed.
They presented it as...
This is why you're in surgical menopause. The removal of the uterus does not cause menopause.
No.
Only the removal of the ovaries causes menopause.
I think it was going to be, I don't think I could have gotten them to agree not to do it that way. It seems to be the standard procedure for uterine cancer. I really didn't want it to happen at all, but I
know quite a few women who've refused to have their ovaries removed.
Oh, I wish it had been me.
You're at really, really, really big risk for now is heart attack. With your ovaries gone, you now spring forward in the highest possible echelon of risk for heart attack. Do you have my book down there?
Not yet. No, but I can pick it up.
There's a lot of information there on what happens after the kind of surgery that you had and the kinds of things that we can do to help ourselves in dealing with that. Hysterectomy involves removing the uterus and severing the ligaments that support the entire pelvic structure. As a result, the pelvis broadens and becomes wider, and the blood supply is disrupted. All right, there can be chronic inflammation. More than one-third of U.S. women have had a hysterectomy by age 65, one of the highest rates in the world. All right, and 20 million women who've had hysterectomies now indoctrinate their doctors, sisters, and friends to just do it. Certainly there are reasons to have a hysterectomy, and it is certainly possible that your reason was an adequate reason. I know that uterine cancer is fairly easy to reverse. And here's one MD, he says, removing the uterus is like pulling out the cork from an upside-down wine bottle. Right? The result is going to be incontinence, bowel problems, and as a matter of fact, 60% of women. So those are some things that we really, really want to think about. Yes, your bones, but more, how do we keep your heart healthy, and how do we support your pelvis? I hope that the doctor has encouraged you to do pelvic floor exercises, sometimes called Kegel exercises.
Well, I know about Kegels well, but my doctor never mentioned them.
Okay, so you're doing about 500 Kegels a day?
No, I haven't been, But I'll work on it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, 100 five times a day is a good place to start.
Does doing biking or running or any of these other things help, you know, take the place of some of that? Or swimming or yoga?
No, it doesn't. And those are great exercises, and I'm really glad you're doing it, and that will help your bones a lot.
I'm not able to do it yet, actually.
The fact that you're ovaries were removed does not necessarily put you at risk for osteoporosis because you're still making 29 other estrogens. You just stopped making estradiol, which is the one that when you stop making that, that's what triggers menopause. Now, most women come through menopause as though they were on the top floor of a 50-story building, and they walk down the stairs. So it takes a while to walk down those stairs. And as you walk down the stairs of the menopause building, different things happen. And it gives you kind of a little time because they're landings, right? Where you can kind of stop and catch your breath and say, wow, what's happening? You have been thrown off the roof of this 50-story building.
That's the same imagery I've been using to tell people about it, actually.
Yes, and so you are getting all of the symptoms all at once, and the best advice that I can give you is lay low while this happens, because it needs to happen. It has to happen. It's healthy for it to happen, but it's extremely disruptive for it to all happen at once. most women can kind of have one foot in their life and one foot in their menopause life, although I encourage even women who come to menopause naturally and normally to withdraw from their life and just do their menopause, because menopause is worth it. It's worth paying that much attention to yourself. But women who come to menopause surgically, it is critically important, if you want to be healthy for the rest of your life, to just cut loose from your responsibilities insofar as you possibly can.
I wish I could quit my job, but then I would lose my insurance, and I kind of need to be monitored for the next few years to make sure.
Could you work part-time?
I already do. I'm an RN, and I can only stand 20 hours a week of that stuff. But I won't be going back for another 3 weeks.
Well, there you go. You have some time off, and that's good.
That's good. I'm out of the hospital. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
They have me doing paperwork for 20 hours a week, which is harder than you'd think.
Paperwork's extremely hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you saying that you're still working, or I thought you said you had 3 weeks off?
I had 8 weeks completely off from work since the surgery, and now I'm in the period after that, and they put me on light duty because I wasn't healed all the way, so... that she has me on a 10-pound lift restriction, and then after that I'm supposed to go back to the job. But I do plan on going, hopefully taking my usual trip to India in the fall, which is going to be both easy and hard because, you know, it's difficult to take an 18-hour, flight, and while I'm there I'm on retreat, and that's excellent for me, aside from the heat, and, you know, India is difficult in its own ways. But at least, as far as I know, I can still do that trip, so... I'm planning on it, although it's a mix because it's on the one hand it's very strenuous, and on the other hand it gives me my real vacation in the year, and I get to do a lot of meditation and all of that.
I certainly hear you, and I can see how useful and healthy that is for you. And perhaps it is the best thing to just continue that since it's something you've done. Or perhaps you would want to book a retreat at some place like Kripalu or the Himalayan Institute where you could be perhaps a little more comfortable. Since
I definitely feel comfortable, but I know what you mean. I mean, India's no piece of cake.
Especially not for someone... feeling a little unhealed or a little sensitive. It's different hygienically there.
Yeah.
Is perhaps the politest way to put it.
Sure.
And so, again, I certainly can't tell you what to do, but I could offer that you might still be able to have that vacation and have that retreat without going to India, because I do hear some hesitation on your part.
Well, the flights are long.
The flight is long, and yeah, and then you got to do the flight back again too. So, just a possibility of other things that you could possibly do. Are you drinking nourishing herbal infusions right now?
I'm not. I'm actually scared of herbs right now because I want to make sure that I don't. I've read things about red clover that have me a little bit scared of it. And ideally, in about a week or so's time, we're going to have a...
But let me tell you, there is no information on the Internet about red clover that I think is valid.
Okay. That's why I'm calling you.
And one of the worst sites is the Johns Hopkins site, which has a whole smear campaign against red clover. And we cannot find what herbalist wrote it. And so far as we know, it wasn't written by an herbalist. It was written by someone who knows nothing whatsoever about herbs.
Wow. I'm expecting to have information on my tumor that tells the density and the type of estrogen and progesterone receptors. Do you think that kind of information could be useful for me with respect to herbs, or do you think it's kind of impertinent?
I want to go back to the fact that you are focusing on the fringe while you're wearing the scarf. foods contain more phytoestrogens than herbs?
Okay.
Have you stopped eating carrots?
No, I'm sure they're.
Are you frightened of carrots?
No.
Well, there's more phytoestrogens in carrots than there are in red clover.
Well, the only difference I can think of is that when I eat a carrot, I'm eating the whole carrot, and if I take a clover tincture, I'm taking a concentrated form of.
I would never use a tincture. I just talked about nourishing herbal infusions, didn't I?
Yes. That's different than.
Did I say tincture?
No.
I did not say tincture. I would not consider red clover useful against cancer as a tincture. And a tincture doesn't concentrate phytoestrogens.
Okay.
Because, in fact, they're not very soluble in alcohol. They're hormones, and hormones aren't really soluble in alcohol, are they?
I can't see why they would be. Yeah.
Right. So, in fact, making a red clover tincture is going to dilute the phytoestrogens in it rather than concentrate them. There's nothing in a tincture that by and of itself concentrates things. As a matter of fact, usually herbalists make tinctures of poisonous plants so that we can take them at safe doses so they're not as concentrated as if we ate them. For instance, I could never eat a poke root. I would wind up in the hospital if I ate a poke root, but I can tincture the poke root and take one drop of it. So tinctures don't concentrate anything, so far as I know. Tinctures allow us to use plants that have poisons in them at very small doses so that we can get the benefit of those poisons because, as we know, drugs are poisons. So, again, what I want to say is what I said at the very beginning and what I have said to thousands and thousands of people. If you are frightened of phytoestrogens, then you cannot eat any seed, any grain, any bean, any nut, any fruit containing seeds that you eat the seeds, or any root.
I hear you.
And if you're eating those things, then the amount of phytoestrogens in herbs is completely inconsequential.
But could be helpful for symptoms, hot flashes and so forth? Or is it not the phytoestrogens so much that are doing that?
It is not the lack of estrogen from your ovaries being removed that is causing the hot flashes. And it is not going to go on for the rest of your life. It is going to go on for a year or two or three. And then your body will stabilize itself into a new relationship with temperature. But again, all menopausal women everywhere in the world have hot flashes. Except for those who are so devitalized that they don't have enough energy to have a hot flash. In fact, the more hot flashes that a woman has and the stronger those hot flashes, often the better her prognosis for longevity and freedom from heart attack.
Is there anything else we can do about my heart risk at this point? Or is it?
Hawthorn tincture is a wonderful ally, and it can be taken on a daily basis. Or hawthorn berry infusion, or hawthorn leaf and flower infusion. So I was asking you about nourishing herbal infusions, and nourishing herbal infusions are herbs such as nettle, and we use 1 ounce of dried nettle in a quart jar, fill it to the top with boiling water, put a lid on it, let it steep overnight, and then strain it out the next morning, refrigerate the liquid, and drink it. And these nourishing herbal infusions, and I rotate through a few of them, and if you're uncomfortable with red clover, then don't use it. Use nettle. Use oat straw. Use comfrey leaf. Use linden. These are all wonderful nourishing herbal infusions loaded with vitamins and minerals, and I have worked with women who have had severe osteoporosis, and we have actually not just stopped the osteoporosis, we have completely reversed it. One woman who was 63 when she started drinking the nourishing herbal infusions and had severe osteoporosis at 67 was told that she had a better bone mass than she had when she was aged 40.
Wow.
So the nourishing herbal infusions, I think, could become your very, very good allies. I like to include red clover in my round of nourishing herbal infusions to protect me against cancer, to help block the effects of environmental estrogens, to help make sure that there are plenty of short path estrogens in my body. If we take 100 women and we give them phytoestrogenic foods or herbs, the difference between those 25 who make the best use of this, and we can tell by looking at metabolic byproducts in the urine, the 25 who make the best use of the phytoestrogens from food or herbs are 400% less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer than the 25% who are making the least use of those.
Meaning, when you say making use of, are you referring to the way their body...
In other words, phytoestrogens are not estrogens. They are technically phytosterols. They are hormonal precursors, but they are not hormones. I mean, after all, a plant doesn't need estrogen, now does it? So plants not going to make estrogen, but plants do use hormones. And so they make phytosterols, which are the beginning state of hormones, and the plants then make hormones that they need from the phytosterols. Similarly, we can bioconvert those phytosterols into biologically active human hormones. But it requires fermentation in the gut. It requires freedom from antibiotics, freedom from essential oils, freedom from chlorine in the water, freedom from food preservatives in order to put gut flora at its maximum to make use of what is in these plants. Many people consume foods that are rich in phytosterols but don't get any of the hormonal benefit from them because their gut flora has been destroyed by the four things that I just mentioned: antibiotics, food preservatives, chlorine in the water, and essential oils.
When you say essential oils, do you mean topically as well or just internally taken?
Absolutely topically, far worse topically, and even worse in the air.
Oh, so you don't like them in the tub, I take it.
I would not have any essential oil in my home, and I will not use any product that contains an essential oil. I guess you could say I don't like them.
Okay.
They are immune system suppressors, and they are hormonal disruptors. And I certainly would not encourage anyone who has a cancer diagnosis to use something that disrupts their hormones and disrupts their immune system. Again, you're wearing the shawl and worried about the fringe. Drinking red clover is nothing compared to what you're doing with the essential oils to your immune system.
I hear you. That's a radical thought. It seems obvious now from the way, you know, from a chemistry point of view, but I'd never thought about it before because they're so, you know, everybody sells them. Everybody loves them. I mean, everybody in quotes, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, that's what I would say is that, you know, I'm assuming, and I could be wrong, that you took antibiotics after the surgery.
Only in the 24 hours around the surgery, fortunately, I guess.
Great. And then did you do things to recultivate gut flora? Did you start eating a quart of yogurt a week?
I've been eating kraut. I'm a little bit dairy intolerant, so
there's nothing in yogurt that anybody can be intolerant to. In other words, there's no lactose in yogurt.
I eat goat yogurt. I have goat yogurt around, but I don't go through a lot of it because I tend to experience...
A quart a week needs to be your goal. Quart a week of yogurt for good immune system functioning and for priming that gut to be able to get the good from the phytosterols in the foods and plants that you consume so that there are more short-path estrogens in your body. Because what happens when gut flora goes down is we can't get these short-path estrogens, and then the environmental estrogens, which are long-path estrogens, start feeding the cancers.
Can I ask you a different question, or has this been going on for too long? I mean, it's very related.
It's fine with me. I think people are interested.
From all my trips to India, as it turns out, I've been told that I have a chronic, low-lying, occasional outburst infection of Entamoeba histolytica. And I was prescribed doxycycline and Humatin by the Dr. Cahill in New York who diagnosed that. And I would have gone ahead and probably taken it because I'm worried about those guys showing up in my brain or my liver someday, or maybe they'll never show up at all. But the one of the drugs he had me take is he wanted me to take was Humatin, which is really ototoxic. And I already have such rotten tinnitus, which I can live with, but the idea of taking a drug that would make it a lot worse really stressed me out. And I've been sitting on my...
I missed the word. You have rotten what? I'm sorry, you have rotten what? You have ringing in your ears. Thank you.
So that one drug, the one reason I haven't done his treatment is because I did it once in the 90s and it didn't change anything. And I just didn't want to take a drug that I knew was probably going to make the ringing in my ears worse. I mean, I could live with it, but I don't know. I just have been sitting on the fence about the amoeba problem. And you know, since you're talking about gut balance, it's just another... hanging out problem that I have that I haven't figured out how to address, and I, you know, they're
maybe another visit is not the best idea.
It's hard. I have an apartment there. I go there every year. It's hard to imagine ever giving up on India.
So as you say, maybe your body is in relationship to this parasite, and if you go to India every year, you're not going to get rid of this parasite now, are you?
That's possible. Yeah, I mean, I drink bottled water, which, of course, is terrible when I'm there. And I was going to bring a Berkey filter to try to filter all my bottled water this time.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get some of the crud out of there. Unless you don't like Berkeys. You've heard of them. They're activated carbon filters. They're supposed to be...
If it will get everything out, well, then, hey, that sounds reasonable. But most of the time... people get parasites in India not from drinking the water, but from eating some food that's been washed.
It's true. I don't think I'm actually picking up amoebas these days. I mean, you never know. But
they're rampant throughout much of India, and especially in cities. And I say to people, unless you are going to personally prepare every bite of food that you eat, unless you are personally going to wash it in bottled water, you can almost guarantee that you're going to bring some friends home from India.
True. I don't eat salad when I'm there, and I pretty much just eat cooked khichdis and things that, you know, and wash my own dishes and try to keep it filtered water.
And yet you have somehow gotten this.
I've been going for 20 years.
I'm not arguing in any way. I'm simply saying that somehow, at some point, you have gotten this and you took a drug and the drug didn't seem to have any effect, possibly because you were reinfected when you went back. This frequently happens that people return to the scene where they got it in the first place and get it again. I've seen it with, you know, people that have been successfully treated for Giardia, and they go right back to the place where they got it and wind up getting it again, and they say, oh, but I didn't do this or didn't do that. And I'm like, you know, sometimes hysterical hygiene isn't even enough. Sometimes it's just really, you know, there in that place. And, you know, I don't even really know. We know how we think these things are transmitted, but does that mean that we know everything? Well, I know that we don't know everything for sure. So I know that when my parents went to India, I gave them each a 1-ounce bottle of wormwood tincture that I made from fresh wormwood, not from dried, from fresh. And I asked them to put one drop of that in everything they drank, whether it was Coca-Cola, water, tea, whatever. The one drop of wormwood was to go in it. And they traveled around on trains in India for almost 6 weeks and didn't get dysentery and did not bring any friends home with them.
That's wonderful.
Could wormwood be used to get rid of the parasite you have? Not at a level that would be conversant with good health. But certainly it's worthwhile thinking about getting some to take with you to prevent any further thing happening. It is certainly a good guardian. I went on a rafting trip on the Green and Colorado rivers. And, you know, you don't go down rapids with your mouth closed. You open your mouth and you scream. And both of these rivers are loaded with the Giardia. And so I was not at all surprised on the airplane ride home when I started to get sulfurous burps, which is a classic symptom of a Giardia infestation. And, hey, I was where Giardia was, you bet. So I had my wormwood tincture with me, and I took 5 drops of wormwood tincture every 15 minutes on the plane ride home, and I never had another sulfur burp again in my life.
Should I assume that yours object to oregano oil, just as you would any essential oil, because I had been using that?
Absolutely. I would rather see you take the drug than take oregano oil.
Oh, my goodness. It's quite a revelation, I have to say.
Would you say that a drug is a extracted, isolated, concentrated constituent from a plant?
Can be.
Yeah. Well, that's what essential oil is, isn't it?
Yes.
Extracted, concentrated, isolated constituent. Essential oils are drugs, but they are not manufactured under good manufacturing conditions. They do not have a package insert with them, and they are not standardized. So one batch of oregano oil can vary greatly from another batch, whereas when you take a drug, you actually know what you're taking, don't you?
Yeah.
It is standardized, yes?
They like the idea that an essential oil is from nature, you know, instead of from a...
Not from nature. It's not any more from nature than aspirin is from nature. A, from spirea. A, spirea, from spirea. Aspirin is from the spirea plant. But it can kill you, can't it?
Yes.
Yes. The fact that something's from nature doesn't make it safe.
If I've been told to take aspirin to protect my heart in this situation where I'm 7 times more likely...
Doesn't protect women's hearts. Have you ever seen any study or any evidence that low-dose aspirin protects women against heart attack?
I've
the evidence for men is pretty sketchy too, isn't it?
I haven't looked at the evidence. I haven't started taking it yet because I was a little worried about it. I was wondering if whatever it does, I don't even know how it's supposed to protect the heart other than...
It thins the blood, right? It's a blood thinner.
It's supposed to be an anti-inflammatory, I guess.
Slightly anti-inflammatory. Linden infusion is a better anti-inflammatory. And, of course, at this point, even modern medicine is pulling back from this recommendation because they're actually finding more people dying of internal bleeding than would have died from the heart attacks they're supposedly preventing.
Not a good way to go.
Not a good way to go.
I'm a nurse. I've seen it.
Yeah, it's not a good way to go. I mean, death by aspirin is nasty. And whether you take a whole bottle at once or whether you take one every day until something happens, it's not kind or pleasant. So if you can find some good research that makes you think that taking aspirin on a daily basis as a woman will help to reduce your risk of heart attack, then certainly take it. But I have not seen any such studies.
It's the only thing I've been told to do after surgery.
Well, I understand because they have such a limited box of crayons. I have a box of crayons with 72 colors in it and a sharpener. They have only 6 crayons in their box. We can't, you know, we can only feel compassionate empathy and pity for them that they have so few choices. But motherwort is a tremendous heart tonic. It can be used as a tincture. And hawthorn is a tremendous heart tonic. And it can be used as a tincture or an infusion. And you can find lots of information about both of these plants. Motherwort is considered the herb of longevity in Japan, where it is used to keep the heart strong into old age.
That's wonderful. I need to know how to keep my heart healthy because, you know, I'm scared of this heart attack business.
Right. It's a case.
Do I have to worry about cycling on and off of motherwort and hawthorn and linden? You know, like maybe 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, or is it fine to take all the time?
So you have to eat carrots for 3 weeks and then not eat carrots for 3 weeks? Because the carrots aren't effective after 3 weeks?
I heard you mention.
Hello. They're not drugs. These are not drugs. Even drugs. If somebody was taking a blood pressure drug, would you have them take it for 3 weeks and then not take it for 3 weeks?
No, of course not.
There'd be idiocy, wouldn't it?
There was something about OSHA you had mentioned that if you take it too often or too constantly, it can stop being effective. In the previous call,
I said echinacea. OSHA should only be taken in the acute situation.
Okay.
I was talking about preventing anaphylactic shock. OSHA stops anaphylactic shock in its tracks. Now, we certainly don't need to take something that does that on a daily basis, do we?
No.
No, only at the acute instance of it. And I said that some people had found that taking echinacea on a daily basis made it less effective when they had an infection.
Okay.
Because they were taking it on a daily basis. Because, again, this is not something that we really need on a daily basis. These things that I am talking about, hawthorn is in the apple family. So taking hawthorn or eating hawthorn, the verb that I prefer, is the equivalent of eating an apple or a peach or a pear or some cherries.
Okay.
Would you need to eat cherries every day to get the benefit of them? No. And if you ate them every day, would you have to stop to continue getting benefit? No. These are foods that I am talking about. You have been given the idea that herbs are drugs in a crude form. But it is not true. And it has never been true. Herbs themselves are not drugs, and they do not act in drug-like ways. Drugs are single molecules which have been purified and standardized, and they have an arrow of action. You give someone a drug to lower blood pressure, it's going to lower blood pressure. Hawthorn, being an herb, is not purified. It is crude, and it has hundreds of different constituents. So it acts in a global fashion. If someone has high blood pressure and they start taking hawthorn, their blood pressure comes down. But if someone has low blood pressure and they start taking hawthorn, their blood pressure comes up. Is that how a drug would work?
No.
Not a drug. Now, herbs can be made more drug-like. We can make them more drug-like by putting them in capsules. Or they can be made more food-like, and they're made more food-like by taking them as infusions. We have had such a good and rich and wonderful discussion here. And a bit ago, you said, has this gone on too long? And it hadn't. But I'm starting to feel that other people are going, come on, answer my question too.
No, I agree. And I don't want to take that time away from it.
So I encourage you to experiment with nourishing herbal infusions and maybe call back in a week or two or three, and let's continue this discussion.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much, and thanks, everybody, for your patience.
Thank you. Have a great evening. Okay, I'm opening up the line for, let me get here, hold on. Come on now. Hold on, excuse me. Okay, person in the 845 area code, you've been so patient and waiting. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, the line's open if you'd like to talk to Susan.
Hold on, let me turn off the computer, right?
Thanks.
Okay.
All right.
I'm on. Hello?
Hello. Hello. We're waiting for you to talk. We're waiting
Hello.
For your question, please.
Hi. Hi, Susan. I'm calling because I have a wonderful profusion of feverfew, my wild chamomile outside, and I want to know if it's a good candidate for tincturing.
All right, let me see if I can take apart what you just said. First of all, you told me that you had wild feverfew, and you don't.
No, I have other people call it wild chamomile. It's feverfew.
Okay. It's not Feverfew.
Okay, Featherview. What do you?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What do you call it?
Is this a weed we are talking about?
Well, yeah, it came by itself. Yeah.
Okay, it's a weed, and it's small. Yes.
Yes. Well, it's about a foot high now. They're like little bushes all over my yard. They're wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Like daisies. No, I know what it is for sure.
Well, wild chamomile does not look like a little daisy.
Oh, because when I Googled
wild
it.
Wild chamomile has no rays at all.
Okay. Well, then it is fever.
So you have a plant.
Mm-hmm.
You have a plant that's about a foot high
mm-hmm.
with daisy-like flowers.
Yes.
Is any of it higher than that?
Occasionally, yeah. And some
mm-hmm.
are lower. It matches the pictures of Feverfew. That's why I'm saying Feverfew.
What does it smell like?
Good question.
I have not found Feverfew as a wild plant in our
uh-huh.
area, but it's certainly possible that it escaped
mm-hmm.
from cultivation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what this is, actually.
Is it pungently aromatic?
Yeah, I would say so.
It has a really strong smell.
Mm. I'm going to go and smell it right now.
Okay.
I think it's not overwhelming.
Feverfew has an overwhelming smell. I've found now one field guide
that says
escaped from cultivation. You may occasionally find the Feverfew, and you can tell that it is Feverfew because of the pungent and strong aroma.
Right, it's stinky. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it does have a pungent and strong aroma.
Yes, it does.
And you want to use this for what?
Is it something that I can use as a tincture? That's what I'm wondering.
For what?
Well, I've heard that it can be good for migraines, for arthritis.
Only useful for people with migraines when eaten fresh on a daily basis.
Okay. And how about the myth? Is it a myth that it's good for arthritic symptoms?
I would not personally want to use a plant that has such a strong smell
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis.
Okay.
That strong smell comes from an oil in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And oils in plants have to be processed by our bodies, and that can cause difficulty in both the kidneys and the liver. So long as we don't use those plants in a strong preparation, we're pretty much okay. But I was picking chamomile, wild chamomile, in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And a Dutch woman came to me and she said, I just want you to know that if you brew that for more than 2 minutes, you will wind up in the hospital.
Whoa. Hmm.
And, of course, chamomile is very closely related to Feverfew, isn't it?
Yes,
matter of fact, you started out by saying it was wild chamomile.
That's what I read, that it is sometimes called wild chamomile.
So, there you have it.
Would you recommend then not tincturing it? I mean, I'm enjoying it just as it is in my yard. The bugs don't.
Well, that sounds perfect. I would just enjoy it.
Yeah, and it's a good.
Do you have migraines?
No.
Yeah, rub it on your ankles as a bug repellent. Great idea.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Rubbing it on your ankles as a bug repellent is a fabulous idea.
Okay, that's how I'm going to use it. I have a question about tincturing, also, if I may. I like to use vodka as a tincturing agent, but I know that the potency of the vodka I use, which is 80 proof, is less.
Mine as well not even make tinctures.
Really? Okay. I was wondering about that. That's what I want to
find. 100 proof vodka.
It has to be 100 proof. Is there
it has to be 100 proof.
Does it have to be potato or grain? Is it one or the other, or is it, does it matter?
No. It doesn't matter, but it has to be 100 proof. When we're making a tincture, we are working by osmosis.
Okay.
So in order to set up osmosis, we have to have a semi-permeable membrane and two different solutions on either side of the membrane, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, most plants are about 75% water.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Your 80-proof vodka is 40% vodka and how much water?
Don't know.
60%. 60 and 40 make 100.
Okay. Okay.
So the difference between 75 and 60 is not very big.
Got you.
So there's going to be very little passage through the cell wall. That's why I said you might as well not even bother making a tincture with 80-proof vodka.
Okay.
Whereas the 100-proof vodka is 50% vodka and 50% water, and the difference between 75 and 50 is big.
Okay.
And this allows osmosis to pull from the plants the medicinal qualities and to deposit them into the alcohol.
Okay. That makes sense. Do you recommend a vodka? I'm so afraid of getting vodkas that have been contaminated by Chernobyl, for instance, when you read that it's Polish vodka or whatever, German vodka. Is
well, then buy an American vodka.
Would you recommend one?
No.
No, okay, because I don't know vodka.
No, just buy a vodka made in America.
Okay, American-made
vodka. Doesn't that make it easy?
I hope. I mean, then we have our other problems here, but okay. Then it doesn't matter whether it's grain or potato, yes?
I have never asked what my vodka is made from.
Okay.
I buy 100-proof vodka. I buy it in big bottles. I buy a case at a time.
Okay.
I buy American-made vodka.
All right, that's my answer then.
Other than that, I don't know what they're making it from, and I'm not particularly worried.
Okay, wonderful.
There are a lot of other things that are much more worrisome to me. Nanoparticles in sunscreen that accumulate in the brain, that worries me.
Mm-hmm.
What my vodka is made of doesn't worry me at all.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Wonderful.
Okay, green blessings. Good night.
May I ask another question?
I think we should go on to the next person.
Okay.
We've already answered a couple of questions, and you can certainly call back in future weeks.
Very good. Thank you.
Hi. Okay. Let's see. Person in the 206 area code, would you like to ask Susan a question?
Yes, I would.
Go right ahead, please.
I had about 4 or 5 days ago what seemed to be a cyst on my labia, and I looked up some things on the internet, of course, and I just decided I was going to do some hot Epsom salt baths, and it seems like now 4 or 5 days later, it's mostly gone, but not entirely, and of course, I'm self-diagnosing and self-treating and looking for any advice.
Okay, I covered this kind of thing in down there. And first of all, it's not really a problem. Cysts tend to come and go on their own. Certainly, you know, no particular problem with taking an Epsom salt bath. Many people do it and enjoy it. I have a friend who likes to soak his head in Epsom salts if he feels like he's been psychically attacked. On the other hand, is it doing anything at all to the cyst? I don't know if it's doing anything that hot water wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So, sounds like you're doing great.
Okay.
Doesn't
well,
sound like
I'm
a
gonna
problem.
Get
it and sounds like what you're doing is fine. And if you want, you know, a lot more information about, you know, comfrey or oak bark or things like that, there's lots of that in down there.
Okay, great. I'm going to get a copy of your book. Thank you.
Goody. All righty. Good night. Green blessings.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Hi.
Hey.
Okay. Let's see. Let's try to dig into this huge stack, which we're never going to get through. But I'm going to ask you to try to make some of the responses to the email succinct so we can get through as many as we can tonight so they don't pile up to next week?
It's a deal.
Okay. I'm 3 months pregnant with a large fibroid
in a bad spot of the uterus, growing rapidly. Preterm labor may be a big fear if the fibroid continues to stay where it is and grow. Hoping for natural remedies I can use safely during pregnancy to shrink it.
Well, I know this sounds like shameless self-promotion, but in fact, down there, the Wise Woman Way does have a whole chapter on fibroids and things that we can do, and information from midwives as well about fibroids and pregnancy. And on page 222, it says, babies born to women with fibroids are not more likely to die or to have birth defects. For the vast majority of women, fibroids are not important during pregnancy. Fibroids that grow as the pregnancy progresses will shrink after the birth. And although doctors panic about them, they are rarely a problem. The women who are most likely to miscarry are the women with the smallest fibroids. And although women with fibroids are told that they're at increased risk of preterm labor, 90% of women with large fibroids go to full term. So beyond that, yes, there are a lot of remedies, and I'm just going to read one to you. This is a 3,000-year-old Chinese remedy for women with fibroids, and I call it the Triple Goddess Gift. It consists of equal parts of chickweed tincture, motherwort tincture, and cronewort tincture. And this is taken by the dropperful. This is quite safe to take during pregnancy, and it is usually taken anywhere from one dropperful three times a day to as much as two dropperfuls four times a day, depending on the size and the severity of the fibroid and the woman's reaction to this. You asked me to keep these short, so I'll keep it short.
Yes. Okay, very good. Thank you. I am writing on behalf of my mother because she doesn't speak English. She has liver cancer and is asking for recommendations in regards to painkillers and an optimal diet.
Okay, well, one of my mentors is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She's now not in her body anymore. But when she was in her body, she was pretty fierce about people with terminal cancer getting as much morphine as they wanted. And morphine is a fabulous painkiller. It is certainly, you know, one of the best. Herbalists say, I have to kill pain. Nothing is better than the poppy. And when you have, you know, herbal remedies made from poppy, they usually don't work as well as the morphine does. So that's what I would suggest, is that she, you know, see if she can get a prescription for morphine written for her. And that will definitely deal with the pain. In terms of a diet, any good broad diet would work fine. I certainly know that the liver works better when there are animal products in the diet. I wouldn't overdo it, especially not too much fat. But I wouldn't eliminate anything from the diet at all. Dandelion is one of my favorite liver nourishing herbs. And dandelion can be taken in a great variety of ways. As a matter of fact, I often say that there's no plant more generous than dandelion. Every single part of it can be used, the flower, the stalk, the leaves, and the roots. It can be harvested at any day of the year and prepared in any way to make an effective liver-strengthening, liver-protective, liver-healing remedy. Wow. No wonder we all love dandelion so much. If she is doing chemotherapy or taking drugs to help deal with her liver, she may also wish, before taking each dose of the drugs, to take some milk thistle seed tincture, which is, to my mind, the queen of hepatoprotective herbs. And taken before any insult to the liver, It allows the drug to work its anti-cancer effects, but prevents any damage to the liver. So those are a few possibilities for your mother.
Thank you. She also said in this email that she wanted to thank you for creating a space where people outside of the U.S. can connect and learn about themselves and herbs, and for reminding us how to take back our power into our hands. She sends you violet blessings.
Oh, thank you.
Yay. Okay, the next one. My brother heard you on radio and sent me an email recommending you. I visited your site. I had a congestive heart attack in 2010, 5 stents put in my heart to keep me breathing. Prior to that, I never went to doctors because I'm a Christian Scientist. There are a bunch of other paragraphs I'll break to the bottom where it says, does your herbal work address transitioning off of medical drugs? And she's on hypertension pills, aspirin, water pill, potassium, taken off of the blood thinner Plavix in February. So she had a heart attack, and she wants recommendations on what to do.
Well, certainly hearts seem to be a bit of a theme tonight. And we've been talking about the two plants that I really like for strengthening and tonifying the heart. And hawthorn is specifically considered to be a plant that is helpful for people with congestive heart problems. Hawthorn can be used as a tincture of the berries, or either the hawthorn berries or the hawthorn leaves and flowers, all of which can be bought on the herbal market. They're very easily available, inexpensive. Can be used to make an infusion using 1 ounce of dried herb in a quart jar, filling the jar to the top with boiling water, putting a tight lid on that, and letting it steep for 4 hours or overnight, my preference, then straining it, retaining the liquid, refrigerating that, and drinking that quart of liquid over the next day or two. Hawthorn leaf and flower comes as one thing. It's hawthorn leaf and flower that you buy. It's very tasty. I very much enjoy it. Hawthorn berry, also a wonderfully tasty infusion. I personally take a dropper full of hawthorn tincture every day. I started doing this because I have another show on. That show is on Healthy Life, healthylife.net. And it's a one-hour show that is monthly, and I focus on a different herb each month. Well, some years ago, I was focusing on hawthorn, and I heard myself repeating the words of others, hawthorn for the aging heart, hawthorn for the heart that you want to protect, hawthorn for the heart that you want strength in, hawthorn for the heart that has had a problem in the past. And I thought, hawthorn for the aging heart, oh my gosh, I'm over 65. That's me. So I started taking hawthorn on a daily basis, and I really enjoy it. As I said previously, this is a member of the rose family, and it's equally safe to apples, peaches, plums, and cherries.
Ah, thank you. We have someone here who has a question, I believe. Are you there in the 310 area code?
Yes, hello.
Hi, would you like to ask Susan a question?
Absolutely. Hello, Susan. What a privilege it is to speak with you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Susan, I have been using blue vervain in a tincture for my menopausal problems. It's been the only thing that's helped, and it's absolutely wonderful. My question is that how long may I continue using this? Because I love it. I'd like to take it for the rest of my life. It's changed my perception of the world. It's kind of a mind-blowing plant for me. And also, I'm growing vervain in pots, the European kind, and I'm wondering if I may use that. Will it be similar to the blue vervain? in its power?
The blue vervain is the one that is considered medicinally active.
Okay.
There are other verveins, but I have not met anyone who uses them medicinally.
Okay.
I don't know of any particular contraindication to using blue vervain on a regular basis, and I'm so glad that it has been so successful and useful for you. I'm going to look in the physician's desk reference for herbal medicine and see if they have any cautions against long-term use of blue vervain. It is truthfully not a plant that I have ever used.
Oh, wow.
Partly because it doesn't grow near me, and so I have no particular real desire to use things that I can't get myself. In other words, I don't like to start using something that I might like and then wind up having to be dependent on someone else to procure it for me.
I see.
All right. Now, blue vervain is not even in the physician's desk reference to herbs. I have a book from Germany, which has the Commission E reports, which are the safety standards as set up by the German Commission E. So, and this is called herbal drugs, a rather confusing term, herbal drugs and phytopharmaceuticals. Let's see if blue vervain is in here. Okay. I'm going to have to look in the index because this book is by botanical name. And I use this plant so little that I do not have the botanical name right at my fingertips. H-I, black, blue comfrey, blueberry, blutkraut, blutwurz. No. No blue vervain. So basically, blue vervain is not considered to be a very effective medicinal herb either in Germany or in the United States. And that's kind of my take on it, too. But you're having such good results with it, why not keep on?
Okay, I just was a little, you know, worried, of course. I don't want to put things in my body that could compromise my health. But I'll tell you, maybe it's just a placebo effect, but I feel like it's just altered my mood tremendously.
That sounds fine to me. I certainly have no problem with that.
And the regular vervain, the European vervain, is not useful for menopausal symptoms? Is that what you said?
Well, what I'm telling you is that I was not able to find vervain at all in either the Commission E reports or the physician's desk reference. Now, I have the PDR that I was looking at was published in 1999, but I do have a PDR from 1899. So this book precedes the other one by approximately 100 years, and interestingly enough, there is no PDR for herbs in between. There's the 1899 one and the 1999 one, and absolutely nothing in between. So let's see what they were doing 100 or so years ago with vervain, sulfur, tincture, vinum, A-E, vinum, we want to go before vinum, vina, medica, viburnum, verbena. Now we're looking for vervain, right? So we have verbascum, verbascum, verbena, Vernona, Veronica, Viburnum, and no let's see, A-E-I. Yes, the E would be before Vinum. So even 100 years ago, vervain was not being used very much.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, hey, I guess I found something special.
Found something special for you. Doesn't seem like there's any problem.
Okay, wonderful. And thank you so much, Susan. And it was a pleasure meeting you, and you're one of my idols.
Thank you so much. Green blessings. Good night.
You as well. Good night.
Hi there. Okay, let me...
Don't hang up. That thumb is hardwired to the goodbye. Goodbye, press end. No, don't, Susan.
I'm from Italy. I'm an herbalist and a feminist, and I have a question about picking red clover, but I find more white clover. Is it the same for breast cancer prevention?
Basically, white clover and red clover are interchangeable. There are some fair differences between them. The flower head of the red clover is much bigger, and this makes it a whole lot easier to pick than the white clover. It's a stoop labor anyhow. This herb grows kind of low, and you got to bend those knees and get down to pick it. And you got to pick, 4 to 6 white clover blossoms for every one red clover blossom. So you got 4 to 6 more times you got to bend those knees. Ouch, ouch, ouch. You know, it gets to you after a while. It's one of the reasons why the Native Americans abandoned white clover and started using only red clover. Next, we see when we're picking the red clover that it's very easy to find what I call perfect red clover blossoms, a red clover blossom in which every individual floret is open and the bees are coming to, and it's all beautifully colored, and it's just, ooh, pick me, pick me. Whereas in the white clover, it tends to bloom from the bottom up so that you can get plants that aren't blooming, that the clover head isn't open at the top, but it's open at the bottom. Or you can get them where they're open at the top, but they're already brown at the bottom. So it's pretty hard to really find any white clover blossoms that are really, to my mind, good enough to pick. The leaves and stalks of the red clover have far more phytosterols and phytoestrogens than the red clover blossom itself. As a matter of fact, the leaves are said to have about 5 times more phytoestrogens, and the stalks to have 10 to 15 times more phytoestrogens. I believe that that is one of the primary reasons why we use only the blossoms and not the leaves or stalks when we use red clover, as opposed to, say, nettle, where we certainly do want to use the stalk. I don't know what that would be like and what those percentages are in terms of white clover, but I do know that when I've seen people harvesting white clover, they tended to get a lot more leaf and stalk material in with it, and I'm not sure why that was. But if you're going to harvest it, I would, you know, just kind of be careful about that aspect of it. And I think you might have made a little video of us working with the white clover and the red clover this past weekend, Justine. Is that true? Hello, have we lost each other here? I know often you're there.
Can you not hear me?
Now I can hear you.
Okay.
Now I can hear you.
Okay, great. We have someone in the 845 area code. Do you have a question for Susan?
I do.
Well, go right ahead and ask her.
Okay, hi, Susan. I sent you an email. My son has been coughing for about 4 months now. And I took him to the it was precipitated by a cold, and he developed a cough, which didn't go away. And then it got a little better. Then he got another cold about a month later. The cough got worse. We traveled to the Caribbean for 10 days. It didn't go away. And then I finally took him to the pediatrician when we got back, and he thinks it may be asthma. Are you hearing me?
Has anyone tested him for whooping cough?
No, he didn't think it was whooping cough. I'm
has
not
he
sure
had
why.
An immunization against whooping cough?
He actually has. I immunized my kids when they were much older, so.
So he has been immunized against whooping cough.
He has, yeah.
Always my first thought when somebody has been coughing for 4 months.
Right.
Is whooping cough, which is becoming far more prevalent because of the number of people not choosing to immunize and because there is a great tool in adults of whooping cough. And I've had several of my students whose children did, in fact, get whooping cough. So it's, I think whenever there's this kind of cough that's gone on this long, that it's worth testing just to be sure.
Okay.
Because if...
It does get worse at night when he's lying down. Like right now he's coughing. He's not lying down. But it's worse at night. It's not so bad during the day.
Because the cough that accompanies asthma is not going to be every single day for 4 months.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
The cough that comes with asthma is usually on exertion. And it tends to get better at night, not worse.
Yeah. He also has...
Meanwhile, there are things that can be used to help his lungs. Mullein leaf infusion.
Okay.
Mixed half and half with milk is one of the great lung healers.
Okay.
Mullein is at the perfect time to harvest and dry now, or, of course, you can buy already dried mullein leaf. Put 1 ounce of that in a quart jar, the dried leaves, fill it to the top with boiling water, put a lid on it, let it steep overnight. The next morning, strain it out through a woven piece of material, a tea towel, a linen napkin, not just a little metal strainer, because there's hairs in the dried mullein leaf that will be very yucky in your son's throat. So strain it through a piece of cloth, a handkerchief, a washcloth, whatever you have, some piece of cloth. And then mix half a cup of mullein with half a cup of full-fat milk, heat it up, add a little honey to it, and let him drink this as his bedtime drink.
Okay.
And the milk, of course, will help him to sleep and help him to sleep more deeply because one of the things that happens with a chronic cough, especially at night, is it interrupts sleep, and the more sleep is interrupted... The more we cough, and the more we cough, the more sleep is interrupted, and this gets bad.
I know, it's very
so the
bad.
Milk will help him go to sleep. The mullein will heal the lungs. If it is asthma, if it is something that's going on with the sensitivity to something, the mullein will help remove that. And he can continue to drink that mullein milk. Most adults and children love the way it tastes, and he can drink that as his before-bed drink for as long as he wants to, as long as you're willing to make it for him.
All right, that sounds great, Susan.
Okay.
Thank you.
Green blessings to you and your son.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. You there, Susan?
I am here.
Okay. The Sport here is telling me that there's that the website host who hosts our radio show is experiencing issues with the host dial-in number. So if you get disconnected, that's why. We'll just hope that doesn't happen.
Okay.
Okay. This is an email from a live-out apprentice, and she said it was great to see you this weekend, and she... on Sunday had issues with pain and blood in her urine, and thinks it might be kidney stone, said you thought it might be kidney stone. It ended up being a kidney infection. So the question for tonight is, what herb...
I told her that at the best it was a kidney stone, at the worst it was a kidney infection.
Yeah, okay, well, it is. So the question is, what herbs are good for urinary tract kidney infection prevention?
Nettle. Stinging nettle.
Wait,
rebuild. Nettle infusion rebuilds the kidneys and helps to prevent kidney infections as well. If I felt like I was on the verge of an infection, I would probably take a drop of poke tincture. Let me give you an example. A week ago, Sunday, I was on the Woodstock Roundtable. In order to get there at 8:30, I have to get up much earlier than I usually do. And I woke up, and my throat was so sore, I didn't think I was even going to be able to say hello. It was so sore, I couldn't swallow. I took one drop of poke tincture. I put my finger in the OSHA jar, the OSHA tincture jar, and sucked whatever was off of my finger. And I took a big swallow of honey and got myself ready to go and took another swallow of honey. As a matter of fact, carried the container of honey with me. But by the time that I got to the show, so I had been up, I got dressed and got there, maybe it was half an hour, 35 minutes, I had no pain, my throat was totally fine, and I never had another moment's problem with that. So I find poke very active, very effective. If you feel that you're tipping over into an infection, great plant to have on hand.
Great. Thank you. Next one. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge on this radio show. I would like to ask a question. I'm a 60-year-old male and have had sinus problems for many years due to seasonal allergies, having nose broken, playing soccer, and an orbital eye socket fracture from a fall 2 years ago. At that time, an ear, nose, throat doctor said there was nothing that could be done to repair it. Since the fracture, I've had bad headaches and sinus infections, and recently I went to my primary care doctor and told I had a severe sinus infection, recommends a CT scan, but the infection needs to be cleared up with antibiotics. I took them, and it seemed to help, but now it's back after a week and a half of finishing them. No CT scan yet, and I haven't called her to say the infection is back. I'm ready to get off the roller coaster ride and most appreciative of any suggestions you have.
Yes. I was on a panel at an herbal conference once, and there was a person there who was experiencing very bad sinus infections. And, you know, I often feel great compassionate pity for the people who agree to be kind of the victim of these panels, because they always choose three or four people on the panel who are completely at odds with each other or are going to give completely different suggestions. And you often wonder, how is the person even going to make any sense of this? And it certainly was true on this panel. You know, one of the people on the panel said that he was probably reacting to mold in his house and he should either leave his house or tear his house down and totally rebuild it. And, of course, I did not suggest anything quite so severe as that. But what was interesting to me was that all four of us, for once, agreed that the best herb for this person with sinus infections and headaches was horseradish. And horseradish is a fabulous herb for getting rid of infection, opening up the sinuses. Yes, you can just, you know, buy some horseradish at the supermarket and eat it by the spoonful. Okay, maybe some people are saying, wow, maybe tearing down his house would have been an easier thing, but it's not that bad. Or you can actually, if you have access to fresh horseradish, you can tincture it. And you can take horseradish tincture to help clear that up. As you were reading the letter, of course, the thing that was really flashing most strongly in my mind is that this person needs to find somebody who does cranial sacral adjustments. Given the nature of the trauma that his skull has undergone and the reactions he is having from that trauma, and he very clearly draws that line between the trauma and what's happening now, a person who does cranial sacral adjustments can actually undo that trauma for him and allow the flow of blood, energy, and so on to come back in a healthy way, even though there were traumatic injuries.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. And I guess we should also just say that whenever I'm dealing with an infection, that I use echinacea, and I use a drop of echinacea for every 2 pounds of body weight. So let's just say, because it's an easy number, that our person weighs 200 pounds. That would be 100 drops of echinacea. That's about 4 dropperfuls. There's about 25 drops to a dropperful. That's going to vary, but it's not a big deal because we're not dealing with drugs here. So in the acute stage of the infection, that 4 dropperfuls of echinacea tincture could easily be taken as often as every 2 hours. And I find that large doses taken very frequently are, in fact, more effective at clearing infections anywhere in the body than antibiotics.
Thank you. I am 78 years old and take many medicines, blood thinner, heart meds, antidepressants, urinary incontinence med, pain meds, hydrocortisone, and Cymbalta. Are there any herbs I can take to help me that won't interfere with all these medications and that might possibly help me not to have to take them all? Where I was once a robust and full of life, I am now weak and tired most all of the time and feel at my wit's end and looking for some quality of life. Please offer any advice. Thank you very much.
Well, again, this is somebody that it would be wonderful if they were actually here and we could actually talk to her or him, whoever it is, because it's a whole lot to try to sort out without any feedback there. What I often do in situations like this is I kind of start at the near end. Like, okay, what was the most recent drug you were prescribed and why were you prescribed that drug? And what could we use instead of that drug, or what can we use to correct that condition so that you don't have to take that drug? Now, what I find frequently is that the most currently prescribed drug has been given because of a side effect from another drug. And so then we have to go back, okay, what was the drug before that that was causing the side effect that you're taking this other drug? And then, well, gosh, an awful lot of times, the one before that was actually prescribed to deal with the side effect from a previous drug. And so we wind up going back as far as we need to until we actually find a drug that was actually given for some particular health problem, not just the side effect of another drug. And this is alarmingly ordinary scenario where people are given one drug and they have a side effect and they're given another to deal with the side effect and so on and so forth. And not my personal experience, but experience as has been shared with me, is that the antihypertensive drug may be the one that is giving you the most problems. I'm wondering about the antidepressive drug and if this was given because of some other drug that you were taking. But again, far too much to give any simple answer to. We have been talking tonight. Our theme tonight has been strengthening the heart and helping the body to have a good and healthy blood pressure. And we've been talking about my two favorite herbs for strengthening the heart. And hawthorn is just ideal for lowering blood pressure. And as you recall, it's as safe as eating an apple. So if you're allowed to eat apples or peaches or pears while taking the drugs you're taking, then hawthorn berry or hawthorn leaf and flower would be absolutely safe for you. As a matter of fact, I don't know of any contraindications, even if you are taking other heart medications, for instance, like an antihypertensive drug. The thought nowadays about antihypertensive drugs is that they are incredibly overprescribed and that a great many people are prescribed an antihypertensive drug on the basis of one blood pressure reading at a doctor's office, which is probably going to be higher than normal. And blood pressure, of course, is supposed to rise and fall throughout the day. I know the dentist that I go to will often ask for blood pressure to be taken before work is done there. And she has some very interesting and very strict rules about it. She doesn't allow the sound system that's playing music to be in the room where the blood pressure is being taken because she says if music is playing, it drives your blood pressure up. She wants people to be left alone, to be calm and very comfortable for, she prefers 5 minutes, but they can't stand that 3 minutes before she will even take a blood pressure reading. Let's contrast that to what happens in most doctor's offices, where you're pressured, you feel stressed, and somebody is coming in and they're taking your blood pressure. And, you know, it's almost like suddenly we become a child again and we go, oh my gosh, am I going to pass? Did I get the right answer? Is it okay? And that, of course, is going to guarantee that it's not. Also, quite a few doctors nowadays are actually taking a blood pressure reading on both arms and not treating high blood pressure unless there's a significant difference between the two arms or unless the blood pressure is extremely high in both arms. But what is being treated nowadays in many cases is what's called pre-hypertension, in which these drugs, which can actually do all of the things that this woman is talking about, start to be used. And it's not that I'm against drugs. It's certainly not that I'm against surgery. Both drugs and surgery have their place. But I am going to put forth an opinion here that this woman is being over-medicated. And I'm guessing that every health professional who's listening is going, you bet your boots, Susan, she's being over-medicated.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We have, it looks like, about 11 minutes left, and I've just been sifting through all of these questions, and there's so many that we're not going to get to tonight, and there's a lot related to diet and health and nutrition questions and a bunch of others, but there are two that kind of came to the top of the pile here, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to answer these two questions in the next 11 minutes, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So they're both really short ones, so I'll tell them to you both, and then you can decide which one you're going to answer first and then go on to the second one. If you want me to repeat it, I will.
Sure.
Hi, Susan. I would like to know if there are any herbal remedies for scabies, topically or internally. Thank you. Second question, different person. I am a huge fan and love your books. I was curious. I am breastfeeding my two-year-old, and do any of the anti-fertility herbs interfere or are not safe to be taken when breastfeeding? Thanks so much.
Okay, scabies, for those of you who don't know, is a parasite that literally gets under your skin and it causes intense itching. We all have this classic image of Napoleon in our minds with his hand in his jacket. That's because he had scabies and he was itching. As a matter of fact, his entire army, when they came back from Russia, was infected with scabies, and it was a scene because it's an almost uncontrollable itch, and you can cause secondary infections because you tear open your skin with the scabies. It's not fun. Usually starts between the toes or between the fingers and works its way up to under the arms and in the groin. One thing to be scratching your toes and fingers is a whole other thing to be scratching your crotch in public. So scabies is pretty easily passed. You can get it from the towel of an infected person. You can get it from sleeping on the sheets of an infected person or, of course, being in bed or having sexual fun with a person who has scabies is a sure way to get it. Scabies likes to come into open pores. So if you take a hot bath or a hot shower and then use a towel that has scabies, oh, those scabies are so happy to jump right onto you. Once we have scabies, what can we do besides poisoning ourselves? I have used this remedy with a variety of people, and it does seem to work. It requires two things, which are not exactly easy to get, but they're not impossible to get either. And that is green soap and sulfur ointment. Green soap is available at most drugstores. It won't be out on the shelf. You'll have to ask for it. Green soap is an alcohol-based soap. And you get in a hot bath, we're going to get those pores open, we're going to get those scabies scared, and we're going to put a lot of green soap in that bath. And that alcohol-based soap just drives them right out of your skin. And then you pull the plug down the drain, they go. And then, coming out of the bath, hot with the pores still open, we apply sulfur ointment. Now, it used to be that, again, you could go to any drugstore and get sulfur ointment, but they have been disappearing off the shelf for a while. So at this point, what I recommend that people do is get a can of Bag Balm. It is still sold, and if you have to, you might have to go to a feed store to get it. But actually, I've been seeing Bag Balm in drugstores as well. If you ask for sulfur ointment, they might say they don't have any. But if you ask for Bag Balm, they might very well have Bag Balm, which is sulfur ointment. Okay, it's sulfur ointment for animals, but you know what? Lots and lots of people use that as well. So we get in a hot bath, we put the green soap in there, we drive the scabies out, we get out, we're still hot, our pores are still open, we put sulfur ointment all over us. We're not going to smell good. The green soap doesn't smell great. The sulfur ointment smells like rotten eggs. You're not going to smell good. On the other hand, you won't itch. Okay, now we have a woman who is breastfeeding, and she wants to know if any of a number of completely unspecified herbs would be contraindicated.
Yeah.
Yo, what could I possibly say here? I got no idea. Send your question in and be specific, please.
All right. You want to skip over this question and go to a different one?
But we got to go to a question that can be answered. You know, that's kind of like
herbs. So what's that going to be? Queen Anne's lace seed?
I have no idea what she's taking or what she's talking about. Could be that she's taking Queen Anne's lace seeds, but we don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. We still have 6 minutes, so let me see if I can come up with another question here.
Another one.
Look through and see which one seems.
Anybody asking about the heart? Seems to be our theme tonight.
No. No, we've already gotten through those. Okay, so let's do this one. I came across your article about herpes, herbal remedies. As you can imagine, I'm on a hunt for more research or cures about the herpes virus. I believe everything has a cure. The herbs you mentioned did catch my eye. I was wondering if you can give me tips on where to find these at. I'm from New York, if it helps. Look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for your time and have a nice day. By the way, Susan, I found two new big patches of St. Joan's wort today.
Is this in the letter or is this you to me?
That last sentence was me to you.
Okay, good.
That was me. Oh, by the way. That was me.
Oh, by the way, you found two new patches. Well, far out.
Yes.
That is great.
Yay,
it's not blooming over here by me at all.
Well, it is.
So,
I found it in Ruby. It's just starting.
Good. I'm just saying right here, but right over here, it's not.
Yeah,
so
herpes, probably a day later.
Yeah, herpes is a problem that is dealt with in down there, the wise woman way. And the deal with herpes is that there are several different kinds of herpes, and that so far as we know, there is no cure for it. Currently, about 30 million Americans have some form of herpes, whether that's herpes simplex virus type 2, genital herpes, or herpes simplex virus type 1, which is cold sores, or herpes zoster, which is shingles. There seems to be a lot of herpes, and it's a viral infection, which means that it is definitely capable of staying in the body for your entire life. However, that doesn't mean that there have to be symptoms. As a matter of fact, about 80% of infected people have no symptoms of any kind. So that's what I usually have as my goal when I'm working with someone with an herpes infection or an active herpes infection, is that our goal is to get this person to be symptom-free, not necessarily to get rid of the herpes. It's rather like trying to scrub your arm to get rid of a mole. It's probably not going to get rid of the mole, but it could do you some injury. Herpes hides in the nerves, and any major change, whether we want it or not, can trigger it. That can be fatigue, trauma, hormonal changes, too much sunlight, new job, new home, new relationship, travel, even if we want it, surgery, guilt, even tight clothes can trigger the herpes virus. In down there, I have half a page of homeopathic remedies, as well as a variety of different herbs that can be used. There is a polysaccharide in Self-Heal, which is Prunella vulgaris, and it has a specific activity against the herpes virus, at least in lab animals. In cell-based tests, glycyrrhizic acid from licorice honed in on the herpes virus and caused it to self-destruct. Drop or full doses of either tincture may be helpful. Self-Heal is a common plant in bloom right now, very easy to find and to make your own tincture. Licorice, of course, is an item of commerce, very easy to buy. And we're not talking the candy, we're talking the actual licorice root, right? A anti-herpes salve may contain herbs such as anti-infective echinacea or grindelia, lymphatic movers such as cleavers, calendula, or burdock, antivirals such as self-heal, St. John's wort, lemon balm, and berberine-rich herbs such as Oregon grape or barberry. There is actually a recipe for something called crotch cream on page 370 in down there, and that's from Gretchen at Herb Hill and Amazing Grease. So if you don't want to make it, Gretchen makes it, and you can get it from her at Amazing Grease, G-R-E-A-S-E. Do avoid nuts, and do consider L-lysine if you are having a herpes outbreak. You're going to get the most lysine from halibut, whitefish, chicken, and goat's milk. And we even may have a time for one more question because we're not getting the three-minute signal yet.
Okay, great. Is there an herbal infusion that helps with constipation? Thanks.
Well, let's define our terms here because I find that a lot of people who tell me that they are constipated are not constipated at all and that they are kind of going by some made-up standards. So the biggest killer of people on this planet is diarrhea. Diarrhea is defined as having more than one bowel movement a day. Constipation is defined as having fewer than three bowel movements a week. The vast majority of people are not constipated. Yellow dock, the root tincture, is a gentle and excellent way to help ensure regularity if you feel that you're not going frequently enough. But remember, to be any more than once a day. The large intestine is there to extract the energy or the chi from your food. And if that food moves through the large intestine too quickly, then we become devitalized and lacking in chi. Thank you all for making another Tuesday here at Blog Talk Radio with Susan Weed an exciting and wonderful event. We appreciate you. Without your questions, without your participation, this wouldn't be a very interesting show. So keep coming back. We'll be right back here next Tuesday, Blog Talk Radio with Susan Weed.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Love you. Love you, Monica Jean. Love you, Justine. Love you, my beautiful granddaughter.
Good night. Sweet dreams.
Good night. Good night, all. Green blessings.